Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Tolan. I'm reading today from the White Mountain Independent. The first story, the headline reads, Century of History Gone, Not Forgotten, by Tony Gibbons, staff writer. A small red house on Niels Hansen Lake in Lakeside quietly stood for nearly a century, cradling the lives and memories of the Metty family, who built it in the 1920s. This year, the weathered homestead was razed, marking the end of an era, but not of its stories. Joe Metty, born in that house on a frosty January day in 1937, remembers it as the heart of his childhood. Quote, "As far as I can remember, the house was built in the early 1920s, said Joe. My grandpa's grandma gave it to my mom and dad. It was a one-room house at first, and then Dad added a bedroom and a kitchen. There was no bathroom or running water. We had to get water from my grandparents' house next door." The Metty family's life was simple, but not without hardship. Joe's father, Luis Metty, passed away in a diving accident in Phoenix at the age of 41, leaving Joe's mother, Fern Penrod Metty, widowed with five children and another on the way. It was not an easy time, but Joe said, "Our church helped us, and my grandfather had a big garden with chickens and cows. They lived across the field from us. It was a struggle for my mom to raise us, but we made it work." Joe attended Lakeside Grade School and graduated from Lakeside High School. Growing up in the White Mountains, he spent his winters skating on Rainbow Lake and summers fishing and hunting near Billy Creek. "We'd even build fires on the frozen lake to ice skate around," Joe said. "Back then, they'd cut blocks of ice from the lake to sell for refrigeration." When Joe left home to enlist in the United States Air Force, he encountered modern conveniences for the first time. "I never lived in a house with a bathroom until I joined the Air Force," he said. Stationed in Yuma during the Korean War, Joe met his first wife, Faye, through his younger sister. "Faye lived in Avondale, and we dated long distance every weekend for 3 months before deciding to get married," said Joe. "She was 16 and I was 19. So we went to Reserve, New Mexico, where age didn't matter." After leaving the U.S. Air Force, Joe returned to Lakeside to raise his family, working in construction before joining Navapache Electric Co-op. "I started the first truck shop there and eventually became fleet manager. It was a good job, and they treated me well," he said. Even in retirement, Joe stayed busy painting houses, opening a welding shop, and enjoying the White Mountains with his second wife, Linda, after losing Faye to cancer in 1986. Today, he spends his time tinkering in his shop, riding the trails, and fishing. As for the old family home, time took its toll. "We moved my mom into a mobile home on the property, and no one lived in the house anymore," Joe said. "The floor rotted, and it just wasn't safe. We decided to have it raised this year." Though the house is gone, its legacy lives on in Joe's memories and the stories he shares with his three children, Joseph, Jolene, and Mike, five grandchildren, and four great-grandchildren. "It was a good life," he said, reflecting on the past century of family history rooted in the White Mountains. The headline of the next story reads, Springerville Coat and Shoe Giveaway Warms Hearts and Feet, by Jen Moriera, staff writer. This November, the town of Springerville partnered with Operation Warm to bring warmth and hope to the community's children through a 3-day children's coat and shoe giveaway. Held November 12th to 14th at the Springerville Heritage Center, the event ensured that local kids would have access to essential winter clothing across Round Valley. Operation Warm, a nonprofit organization, supplied the brand new coats and shoes for the giveaway. Founded in 1998, the organization has distributed over 5 million coats and expanded its mission to include shoes, aiming to boost children's confidence and ensure their comfort during harsh weather. By partnering with schools, community groups, and local governments, Operation Warm helps fill a critical gap for families in need. Over a period of 3.5 days, the event served 91 groups, including 94 boys and 91 girls ranging in age from 6 months to over 16 years old. Parents and guardians picked up items for children who couldn't attend. Feedback from the community was overwhelmingly positive, with many expressing gratitude for the opportunity to secure high-quality winter essentials for their children. As Springerville Events Coordinator Christy Prather noted, quote, "It was a pleasure helping the community's kids. I do believe that this was a successful event and look forward to future possibilities to help our town." While the main focus was on meeting the needs of local families, the statistics illustrate the program's reach. Coats were distributed in sizes ranging from toddler to youth, with sizes 7-8 and 14-16 being the most popular. In addition to coats, dozens of pairs of shoes were provided in both toddler and children's sizes, with toddler size 10 and children's size 3 among the most requested. The program's success was celebrated by local leaders. Springerville Mayor Shelley Reedhead shared her gratitude. "I love this community. It makes my heart happy to be able to help so many families stay warm this winter," she said. Springerville Town Manager Tim Rasmussen commended the collaboration behind the event. "We're proud to help give out hundreds of brand new shoes and coats to children and families around Valley. I'd like to thank Operation Warm, as well as a former colleague, Marcy Bafford, for finding the program and working with the provider. Special thanks to town employees Christy Prather and Beth Conlon, whose organization helped make the event a success," he said. The success of this year's children's coat and shoe giveaway has inspired plans for future events. The town has announced that it will host another giveaway during the Santa at Becker Park event on December 7th. Donations to Operation Warm can be made directly through their website at operationwarm.org. That's no spaces, operationwarm.org. The next headline reads, "Navajo County Board of Supervisors approves solar project outside Snowflake." The Navajo County Board of Supervisors approved a special use permit for the Stellar Red Hills Solar Project at the November 12th meeting, setting the stage for a 1,000-megawatt solar power facility and battery storage system northwest of Snowflake. The project, sprawling across 9,213 acres of grazing land, promises renewable energy innovation but has sparked mixed reactions from the community. Navajo County Planning Manager Cody Cooper introduced the project, detailing its scope. "The property is about 5.5 miles north of Snowflake," Cooper said. "It includes 15 parcels owned by Aztec Land and Cattle Company, Flake Ranch, Langley AZ Ranch, and the Arizona State Land Department. Historically, this land has been used for grazing, with the nearest residential neighborhood located 1.3 miles southeast." The facility will feature photovoltaic solar panels and a battery storage system capable of holding 1,000 megawatts of electricity for up to 4 hours. It will also connect to SRP Sugarloaf substation via a high-capacity transmission line. Construction is set to begin in late 2026, with operations targeted by the end of 2028. SRHS has committed to protecting the area's cultural and environmental assets. The company's studies identified 7 historical sites within the project area, two of which are eligible for inclusion in the National and Arizona Historic Registers. These sites will be preserved or mitigated under state and federal guidelines. The environmental assessments also suggest minimal effects on protected species in the region's scenic views. The remote location and natural topography are expected to limit visual and ecological disruption. During the public hearing, three people spoke with opinions ranging from strong support for renewable energy to concerns about long-term consequences. A Gulf War veteran and environmentalist from Sholo voiced her approval. "This solar battery project is excellent," she said. "We have a history of clean energy in Navajo County. Decisions need to be based on science and logic for the good of all." In contrast, another local resident expressed fears about the environmental costs of large-scale solar farms. Quote, "These megastructures have devastating, life-altering consequences for the environment and surrounding community," she said. "They leave scars that won't heal in our children's lifetime." Snowflake rancher Galen Flake highlighted the effect on his family's century-old ranch. "This proposal will claim five sections of our ranch, which contain critical water sources and support local wildlife," Flake said. "Losing this land will disrupt our operations and long-term sustainability." The board grappled with balancing private property rights and the concerns of ranchers leasing the land. Chairman Jason Whiting clarified that the county does not dictate which utilities purchase energy or the types of energy produced. "We have a private landowner who wants us to use his land the way the Constitution allows, and a business exercising their rights, and our role is to ensure the project complies with our ordinances," he said. Supervisor Daryl Seymour noted the county's long-standing support for renewable energy. "This area has always been known for its wind and solar potential," he said. "We've supported several similar projects to generate jobs and boost the economy." Whiting acknowledged the conflict between ranchers and landowners. "When you lease land," he said, "you don't have the control you'd like. I'm not sure the government has a role in dictating how private landowners use their property, but the impact on ranchers concerns me." The board ultimately voted unanimously to approve the project, and while SRHS has cleared the county's approval process, several steps remain, including securing a utility company to purchase the energy and gaining approval from the Arizona Corporation Commission. Thank you for listening to Sun Sounds. The next story is headlined, "From Jurisdictional Issues to Lack of Resources, the Indigenous Women Testify on Missing and Murdered Indigenous People," by Shandin Silversmith and Jim Small of the Arizona Mirror. Paul Begay, Anne Curley, Ella Mae Begay, and Everett Charlie are the names of only a handful of Navajo people missing that Navajo Nation Council delegate Eugenia Charles Newton shared as she addressed a congressional committee hearing on missing and murdered Indigenous people. "These are a few of the names I wanted to read aloud so they know they are not forgotten," Charles Newton told the House Appropriations Committee oversight hearing on investigating the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. "The victims are both men and women, but it is Native American women who disproportionately go missing and are murdered in cases that are rarely solved, if there's an investigation at all. The Bureau of Indian Affairs estimates that there are approximately 4,200 missing and murdered Indigenous people cases that have gone unsolved." Charles Newton said the total number of known people missing from Navajo Nation is 75, and they do not know the number of Navajo people who have been murdered. Quote, "It's unaccounted for because we lack the manpower to track these cases properly, and we also lack the infrastructure to record all cases, she told them. Charles Newton was one of five Indigenous women who testified to the committee on November 20th, and each shared their experiences working and advocating for missing and murdered Indigenous people in both rural and urban settings. As part of the testimonies, each woman also provided recommendations on how federal agencies can better support MMIP efforts. Many of the concerns highlighted in the hearing related to continued jurisdictional issues among federal, state, and the tribal entities, the lack of readily available resources for investigations involving MMIP cases, the need for more comprehensive data collecting regarding Indigenous peoples, and accountability among federal agencies. Quote, my inner being agonizes over the lack of worth given to Native women and the senseless acts that lead to their harm, unquote, said Mary Jane Miles, vice chairman of the Nez Perce Tribal Executive Committee and member of the Nez Perce tribe. In the past, people in power have not cared about Native women, she said, but their families and tribes do care. Over and over again, the women who testified spoke about the jurisdictional confusion that, many said, is ultimately used as a way to pass the buck and avoid doing the police work required to seek justice for the victims. Cheryl Horn, a member of the Assiniboine tribe of Fort Belknap, who sits on the Montana Missing Indigenous Persons Task Force, spoke about the difficulty in getting any help from the tribal, county, and federal law enforcement agencies when two of her nieces went missing. Quote, none of these jurisdictions want this case, she said. I don't want jurisdiction used as an excuse not to do it, which is what I'm seeing in Montana. Likewise, Urban Indian Health Institute Director Abigail Echohawk told the committee that the, quote, maze of jurisdiction is just an excuse, unquote, that allows law enforcement to, quote, not pay attention to those they don't care about, and those they don't care about look like me and the other women on this panel today. Charles Newton drove home exactly how jurisdictional confusion has failed Native victims, telling the committee about her own kidnapping and brutal, repeated rapes when she was just 17 years old. She said she accepted a Coca-Cola from a man she knew, only to wake up later, tied up in a shack and held for more than a week. Quote, he raped me repeatedly. He beat me. He broke my ribs, broke my cheekbones. He tried to carve his initials into my pubic area, she said. And although Charles Newton knew who her rapist was and told police over and over, she said all they kept asking her about was where the shack was located, a question she could not answer. Because of that, jurisdiction was never settled, and her rapist was never prosecuted, and now she represents that man as a Navajo Nation delegate. No one came to search for her, she said, because tribal police told her family that she'd just gotten tired of living in her tribal community and had left. That was an excuse, Charles Newton said, but her family believed it because they have been conditioned to believe the police. Nobody wants to solve these cases. They just want to say that they're closed, she said. I wish we had law enforcement where everybody took their jobs seriously. The tendency to blame Indigenous women who are victimized, conditioned by decades of stereotypes that treat Native people, and especially Native women, as less than human, makes it that much more difficult to get non-tribal law enforcement to respond to the cases the same way they would if the victims were white women, Echo Hawk said. Quote, this cannot depend on one person, on one organization. It must be a systematic approach that upholds accountability, she said. It is something we've been calling for, but no one has been willing to take up the cause. Molly and Bryant, a member of the Penobscot Nation in Maine, and the incoming executive director of the Wabanaki Alliance, said the failure to recognize the crisis taking place on tribal lands and against Native Americans living in urban centers is only the latest trauma visited upon Indigenous people by the U.S. government. Things like the American government stealing land from Native people and then forcing them into boarding schools where they literally had their culture beaten out of them have left Indigenous people, quote, less than human, unquote, and invisible. Quote, it's so much more than laws and jurisdiction. It's where we've been placed in society, she said. We love this place and we need it to love us back, unquote. Subcommittee Chairman Representative Mike Simpson, R. Idaho, called the hearing as part of the House Interior and Environment Appropriations Subcommittee, which oversees funding for the Department of Interior. More than 40% of American Indian and Alaska Native women are raped in their lifetime, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. For Indigenous women between the ages of 10 and 24, homicide is the number three leading cause of death. Quote, 40% of all victims of sex trafficking are identified as American Indian and Alaska Native women, Simpson said. In 2023, he continued, over 5,800 American Indian and Alaska Native females were missing, and 74% were children. This is tragic and unacceptable. Simpson said, as part of the fiscal year 2025 House Interior Appropriations Bill, the Bureau of Indian Affairs Public Safety and Justice Programs received a $191 million increase, including an additional $141 million for criminal investigation and police services. Simpson said the bill also provided an additional $13.5 million for a total of $30 million for the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Initiative, which focuses on helping address the MMIP crisis, including resources for criminal investigators, software platforms, and evidence recovery equipment. Quote, these steps are just the beginning, he said. The goal of the hearing was not to point fingers, Simpson said, but to solve a problem. Quote, we want to know what's working and what's not working, things that might need to be changed, and that is the purpose of the hearing, he said, because as the Appropriations Committee, it is their responsibility to fund many of these programs. Echo Hawk spoke to the committee on behalf of the Indigenous people living in urban areas who continue to be impacted by the crisis, yet still do not have access to resources promised through the Savannah's Act and Not Invisible Act. Quote, these people are suffering in the same ways the tribes are suffering, Echo Hawk said of Indigenous people living in urban settings. Echo Hawk, who is a member of the Pawnee Nation and serves as the executive vice president of the Seattle Indian Health Board, touched on three major topics related to the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous peoples, the Department of Justice's failure to implement the Savannah's Act and Not Invisible Act, the need for a national alert code for missing and endangered Indigenous people, and the importance of holding the military accountable for violence against Indigenous people. Quote, please ensure that there is accountability for urban Indian populations as we move forward in doing everything we can to achieve justice, Echo Hawk said. Savannah's Act is an effort to improve the federal response to missing and murdered Indigenous peoples including increasing coordination among federal, state, tribal, and local law enforcement agencies. The Not Invisible Act was signed into law in 2020, and it requires the U.S. Department of Justice and Department of Interior to establish the Not Invisible Act Commission, a cross-jurisdictional advisory committee that will develop recommendations to address the public safety challenges associated with missing and murdered Indigenous people. The commission was formed in May of 2022, and it held field meetings in June of 2022, which helped it compile a recommendation report for the Departments of Justice, Interior, and Congress in November 2023. The next headline reads, State Seeking Community Lenders for Microbusiness Loan Program, put together by staff reports. Phoenix, Arizona. The Arizona Office of Economic Opportunity has opened a six-week request for grant application cycle closing on December 11th to select additional lending partners for its Arizona Microbusiness Loan Program. The Microbusiness Loan Program provides access to loan funding for Arizona's smallest businesses, those with five or fewer employees, through community development financial institutions like local banks and nonprofit community lending partners. In addition, microbusinesses that are issued loans also receive financial education and training to ensure the successful outcome of the loans in growing their businesses. The Arizona Office of Economic Opportunity is looking for additional local community lending partners to help manage these microbusiness loans. Community lending organizations interested in helping to do so can learn more about the microbusiness loan program, lending partner criteria and requirements, and submit an application on the Arizona Microbusiness Loan Program's website. In the first two rounds of loan funding, OEO provided funds to six lending partners serving nearly every corner of the state. The Arizona legislature established the program last year, and each qualifying borrower can receive up to $50,000 in loans. The next headline reads, Proposed Hunt Recommendations Available for Review for 2025. This was filed by Dale Hojcik of Arizona Game and Fish Department Community Relations Specialist. The Arizona Game and Fish Department's proposed recommendation for 2025 pronghorn, elk, and population management hunts and limited entry seasons for 2025 to 2026 are available for review at the Arizona Game and Fish Department website. The hunt structures and recommendations were formulated based on the hunt guidelines approved by the Arizona Game and Fish Commission. All questions or comments about a particular game management unit or hunt can be emailed to the following web address, azhuntguidelines@azgfd.gov. That email again is azhuntguidelines@azgfd.gov. The public is also invited to call any of the department's regional offices statewide and ask to speak with a game management biologist. No formal presentations are planned.